You just watched your child have a complete meltdown about their dad's death, the same dad they seem to have processed 2 years ago in therapy. And you're standing there thinking, are we going backward? Did I do something wrong? Why is this happening again? If you're lying awake at night wondering why your child seems stuck in their grief, if you're seeing your 10-year-old suddenly asking questions about death that you thought you'd already answered when they were seven, if your teenager is angry about a loss that happened years ago and you can't understand why they're not over it by now, if you're exhausted from feeling like every time you climb out of the grief hole together, your child falls right back in, if you've been told by well-meaning friends that kids are resilient, they'll bounce back, but what you're actually witnessing looks nothing like bouncing back, if you're second-guessing every parenting decision because you're terrified of saying the wrong thing and causing permanent damage, if you're seeing your child's grades slip, friendships change, or behavior shift, and you don't know if it's normal grief or something you should be rushing to fix, if you feel guilty every time you laugh or move forward with your own life because your child seems frozen in their pain, if you're wondering whether that therapist you took them to 3 years ago actually helped or if you wasted time and money, then you need to hear what I'm about to share with you. You've probably tried giving them space to heal at their own pace. You've likely read books about the 5 stages of grief and tried to figure out which stage your child is stuck in. You've maybe bought journals, encouraged them to talk about their feelings, or enrolled them in grief camps and counseling sessions. You've possibly even avoided mentioning the person who died because bringing it up seems to trigger new waves of sadness. You might have tried to distract them with activities, traveled to create new memories, or over-focused on keeping everything else in their life stable and normal. And despite all of this, despite your absolute best efforts, you're watching your child struggle with the same loss at different times in different ways, and you're starting to wonder if you're failing them. Here's what I want you to understand by the end of this audio. Your child isn't stuck. They're not broken, and you haven't failed. What you're witnessing is actually a sign of healthy development, something I call the lighthouse effect. I'm going to show you why your child keeps coming back to their grief, why this is not only normal but necessary, and exactly how to support them at each new developmental window without trying to rush them to some imaginary finish line. You'll walk away knowing what to expect at each age and stage, what to say when grief resurfaces, and how to stop treating grief like a problem to solve and start seeing it as a companion on your child's growing up journey. But I need you to commit to something. Don't listen to this in pieces while you're doing 3 other things. Your child's emotional future deserves your full attention for the next 20 minutes. Find a quiet space, take a breath, and stay with me until the end. Here's the truth nobody tells you about helping a grieving child. Almost everything you've been taught is designed for adults processing loss, not children who are still becoming themselves. Most advice tells you to talk about the person who died, create memory boxes, and give your child space to feel their feelings. And yes, these things help, but they only address the surface of what's actually happening. Because when you implement these strategies, you're treating grief like a one-time event that needs to be processed and completed. You help your 8-year-old talk about missing grandpa, you validate their tears, you think you're doing everything right, and you are for that moment. But 6 months later, when they're suddenly angry at the dinner table, or 2 years later when they're anxious about you leaving for work, you feel blindsided. You think something new is wrong. You don't realize they're not regressing, they're encountering their loss again from a completely different developmental vantage point, and nobody told you this would keep happening. The real issue is that every system and environment around your child is working against their natural grief process. Schools give kids 3 days off for a death and expect them back ready to learn. Teachers express concern if grief shows up in behavior months later, framing it as a problem rather than part of the process. Pediatricians ask about grief once, maybe twice, then move on to growth charts and vaccinations. Even well-meaning family members start saying things like, "They're doing so much better," or "Kids are so resilient," when what they really mean is, "The child has stopped showing visible signs of sadness, so we can all relax now." Your child picks up on all of this. They learn that grief has an expiration date, that there's something wrong with them if they're still affected, that they should be over it by now. So they start hiding their grief, not because they've processed it, but because they've learned it makes people uncomfortable when it keeps showing up. And here's where it gets even trickier. When you notice your child struggling again with something you thought they'd worked through, your natural parental instinct kicks in. You want to fix it, to push through it, to help them get past this once and for all. So you might overcompensate with positivity, redirecting them away from sad thoughts. You might rush to reassure them that everything's okay now. You might even avoid mentioning the person who died because you don't want to trigger them. But when you try to force grief forward or push through to the other side, you actually make it worse because you're teaching your child that their recurring feelings are wrong. They start to believe something's broken in them. Why am I still sad when mom says we've talked about this? Why does this hurt again when I thought I was better? They begin to suppress and hide, not process and heal. And suppressed grief doesn't disappear, it morphs. It shows up as anxiety, perfectionism, clinginess, anger, or withdrawal. You're dealing with the disguised versions instead of the grief itself. But even if you avoid all these traps, even if you keep talking about loss, even if you understand grief takes time, there's still an invisible enemy at work that almost no one recognizes. What's really happening is the grief timeline trap. And it's the invisible cultural pressure that forces children's grief into adult-sized boxes with expected stages and deadlines, making parents rush healing instead of honoring each child's unique developmental capacity to process loss. See, adults have a relatively stable understanding of death and loss. When we grieve, we're working with a fully formed brain and a consistent worldview. But children? Their brains are literally under construction. The 7-year-old who understands that daddy died doesn't yet grasp the permanence the way their 11-year-old self will. The 9-year-old who knows grandma isn't coming back can't yet comprehend the future milestones she'll miss, graduations, weddings, grandchildren, the way their 16-year-old self will. Each cognitive leap, each developmental milestone, each new window of understanding means they encounter their loss again as if for the first time, not because they haven't healed, but because they're meeting their grief with a more sophisticated brain. And until you address this, until you stop expecting linear progress and start recognizing the spiral pattern, you'll keep misinterpreting your child's natural grief process as failure. You'll wonder why therapy didn't work when your child seems fine for a year, then struggles again. You'll question whether you did something wrong, but you haven't. Your child isn't stuck. They're growing, and their grief is growing with them, which is exactly what should happen. Now, let me introduce you to the grief spiral method, a completely different way of understanding what's actually happening when your child brings up their loss again and again. Here's the insight that changes everything. Your child isn't stuck in grief, they're not regressing, and you haven't failed them when they seem to be back at square one with sadness about someone who died years ago. What's actually happening is that they're revisiting their loss with a more developed brain, and each return is a sign of healthy processing, not a failure to move on. Think about it this way. Your 9-year-old suddenly starts crying about the grandma who died when they were 5. Your first thought might be panic. I thought we'd gotten through this. Why are we back here? Did I do something wrong? But here's what's really happening. At 5, your child understood death in very concrete, limited ways. They knew grandma was gone, but they couldn't grasp the permanence, couldn't imagine their future without her, couldn't process the unfairness or think about their own mortality. Now, at 9, their brain has developed new cognitive abilities. They can think more abstractly. They can project into the future. They can hold complex emotions simultaneously. So they're not re-experiencing the same grief. They're experiencing their loss for the first time with their 9-year-old brain. It's completely new grief from a higher vantage point. This is why the old model of grief, where you're supposed to work through it and arrive at some destination called acceptance, never worked for children.
That model assumes grief is a straight hallway with an exit sign at the end. But children's grief is like a spiral staircase in a lighthouse. they circle back to the same feelings at different heights as they grow, seeing their loss from a new developmental window each time. A 5-year-old understands death differently than they will at 8, then 12, then 16, then 25. And that's not a problem. That's exactly how it's supposed to work. Your role as a parent isn't to push them through floors or rush them to the top of the lighthouse. You're climbing alongside them, pointing out what's visible from each new window. You're the steady presence that says, "Yes, we're talking about this again, and we'll keep talking about it as you grow, because you'll keep seeing new things." This approach is different because it completely reframes those moments you thought were setbacks. When your child asks the same question about their deceased parent that they asked 2 years ago, you're not witnessing failure, you're witnessing development. When they seem sadder about a loss than they were right after it happened, you're not seeing delayed processing, you're seeing expanded capacity to feel complex emotions. The grief isn't getting worse. Their ability to understand what they've lost is getting better. Let me give you the framework we'll use. It's called CLIMB, and each letter represents a step that helps you navigate grief alongside your child as they develop. Chart where they are developmentally, listen for spiral signals when old grief resurfaces. Invite re-conversation by normalizing that understanding changes. Match your language to their current developmental window, and bookmark the climb with rituals that acknowledge you'll revisit this together as they grow. This isn't 5 things you do once. It's a cycle you'll move through repeatedly as your child spirals upward through their grief. Let's walk through each step so you know exactly what to do. First, chart where your child is developmentally. This doesn't mean you need a psychology degree. It means you're taking a moment to understand roughly how your child's brain currently processes death and loss, so you can set appropriate expectations, both for them and for yourself. Young children, roughly ages 3 to 6, are concrete thinkers. They don't grasp permanence. Death to them is reversible, temporary, like sleep or going on a trip. They experience grief in what looks like waves, intensely sad one moment, playing happily the next, because they can't hold the concept of death in their minds continuously. If your child is in this stage and brings up their loss, they're not looking for philosophical conversations about mortality. They're trying to understand basic facts and seeking reassurance about their own safety. Children roughly ages 6 to 9 start grasping that death is permanent, but they often think magically about causation. They might believe their thoughts or behaviors caused the death. They become very interested in the physical and biological aspects of death, what happens to the body, where exactly the person is. When a child in this stage revisits grief, they're often working through guilt or trying to establish a logical sequence of events that makes sense. Preteens and early teens can think more abstractly, but they're also deeply concerned with fairness and their own identity formation. They can understand death is universal and permanent, but now they're grappling with existential questions. Why do people have to die? Why did this person die when bad people are still alive? What does this mean about my own future? They might seem to have processed a loss well years ago, then suddenly be overwhelmed by it as their brain develops the capacity to understand what they've really lost in terms of their own unfolding future. Older teens can hold multiple complex ideas simultaneously. They can think about the person who died as a full human with contradictions, not just good or bad. They can contemplate their own mortality and the meaning of life. When they spiral back to grief, they're often integrating the loss into their developing philosophy of life and their understanding of who they are. So the first step is simply asking yourself, where is my child right now? Not where they should be, not where their sibling is. Where is this specific child developmentally? This allows you to interpret their grief responses accurately instead of seeing everything as either progress or regression. Second, listen for spiral signals, those moments when old grief questions resurface.
Instead of hearing these as alarm bells that something's wrong, you're training yourself to recognize them as developmental growth markers.
Your 7-year-old, who seemed fine with their sibling's death 2 years ago, suddenly doesn't want to sleep in their own room anymore. That's not regression. That's a child whose brain can now imagine permanence and is working through what forever gone actually means. Your 12-year-old, who rarely mentioned their deceased father, suddenly becomes fixated on looking at old photos and asking questions about his personality. That's not obsession. That's identity formation, where they're trying to understand which parts of themselves come from him. Your 16-year-old breaks down crying about a grandparent who died when they were 10, saying, "I miss them so much more now." They're not backsliding, they're encountering the loss with a brain that can now comprehend the full scope of what that relationship could have become. These spiral signals often appear around developmental milestones, starting a new school, reaching puberty, getting a driver's license, graduating, falling in love for the first time. Each milestone is a new window in the lighthouse. From that height, they see their loss in a new context, and they need to process it at that level. Listen for these moments without judgment. Notice them. Think to yourself, "Ah, we're spiraling back around, but from higher up now." The signals might look like sudden questions, changes in behavior, increased emotionality, or new rituals they want to create. Sometimes kids don't have the language to say, "I'm thinking about my loss in a new way," so it comes out as acting out, withdrawal, or seemingly random sadness. When you've charted where they are developmentally, you can interpret these signals more accurately. Third, invite re-conversation by explicitly normalizing that their understanding will change as they grow. This is possibly the most powerful shift you can make, telling your child directly that they're supposed to think about this loss differently as they grow. You might say to a young child, "You might have new questions about grandma as you get older," and that's exactly right. When you're bigger, you might wonder different things about her, and I'll be here to talk about it. To an older child, "You understood dad's death one way when you were 8. You'll probably understand it differently now that you're 11, and that doesn't mean how you felt before was wrong. It means you're growing." This invitation removes the shame that often accompanies re-emerging grief. Kids worry they're supposed to be over it. They see parents' faces fall when they bring up the loss again, and they interpret that as disappointment in them. They start hiding their grief to protect you, or because they think something's wrong with them for still being sad. When you invite re-conversation, you're saying several things at once. You're saying the loss is important enough to keep discussing. You're saying grief doesn't have an expiration date. You're saying their evolving feelings are normal and expected. And you're saying you're not afraid of their sadness. You can handle being a companion in this. Practically, this might mean checking in periodically rather than waiting for them to bring it up. "We haven't talked about mom in a while. I've been thinking about her lately. Do you think about her differently now than you did last year?" Or creating natural opportunities. "I was remembering when your brother was alive. You were so little then. Do you wonder sometimes what he'd be like now?" You're not forcing conversation, you're opening the door and making it clear the door will always be open. Some kids will walk through immediately, others will note that the door's there and return later. The invitation itself is the medicine. Fourth, match your language to their developmental window. This is where you give concrete answers to young children and philosophical space to teens who are encountering the same loss with different cognitive abilities. Let's say the loss is a parent who died by suicide. A 5-year-old asks, "Why did daddy die?" You match your language to concrete thinking. "Daddy had a sickness in his mind that made his thoughts very confused and sad. The sickness became so bad that his body stopped working. It wasn't your fault, and nothing you did caused it." You're not lying, but you're also not giving information their brain can't process. That same child at 10 asks the question again,
But why did Dad kill himself? Didn't he love us? Now you match to their more developed reasoning. Dad loved you very much, and he also had a disease called depression that made it impossible for him to think clearly. The disease lied to him and told him we'd be better off without him, which wasn't true. He wasn't choosing to leave you. He was sick and couldn't see any other option. Both things are true. He loved you, and he was too sick to keep himself alive. At 16, they ask again, "Do you think he thought about me before he died? Do you think he regretted it?"
Now you match to abstract thinking and existential questions. I think the disease had taken over his thinking so completely that he wasn't able to think clearly about you or the future or consequences. I imagine in his final moments, he was in enormous pain and just wanted the pain to stop. I don't know if there was a moment of regret, but I know that who he was as a person, not sick, loved you more than anything. That's one of the hardest parts of this kind of death. We have to hold both the person we loved and the disease that took them and separate those things in our minds. You see how the essential truth doesn't change, but the complexity and language matches where they are. You're not withholding information to protect them. You're offering information in the form their brain can actually integrate. And you're leaving room for the question to be asked again later from an even higher window. This matching also applies to emotions. A young child feeling sad needs you to be present, offer physical comfort, and validate simply, "You're feeling very sad about Grandpa. Sad is okay. I'll stay with you." A teen feeling sad might need space, then connection, and validation that includes complexity. You're feeling sad and maybe angry and maybe guilty all at once. All of those make sense. Grief isn't just one feeling. Fifth, bookmark the climb by creating rituals or memory tools that grow with them, acknowledging we'll visit this together as you grow. This step makes the spiral visible and honored rather than hidden and shameful. A bookmark is anything that marks where you are in the climb and creates a container for revisiting grief as development happens. It might be an annual ritual. Every year on Grandma's birthday, we'll look at photos and everyone shares one memory. As your child grows, the memories they choose and how they talk about them will change. The 5-year-old picks the photo where Grandma is holding them. The 10-year-old picks a photo where Grandma is laughing at something and asks what was funny. The 15-year-old picks a photo of Grandma as a young woman and asks what her life was like before kids. Same ritual, different window. Or it might be a memory box that you explicitly say will be opened at different ages. I've put some of Mom's things in here: her favorite book, a recording of her voice, some letters she wrote. We can look through it whenever you want, and as you get older, different things might mean more to you. You're naming the spiral in advance. Or it might be a simple phrase you use consistently. We carry people we love with us even after they die. How you carry Uncle James might change as you grow, and that's okay. We can talk about it whenever you need to. Then, when they're 10 and struggling with whether it's okay to feel happy when he's dead, you remind them, "Remember how we said the way you carry Uncle James would change? This is that change happening. You're not forgetting him by being happy, you're learning to carry him differently." These bookmarks serve multiple purposes. They normalize revisiting, they create predictable containers where grief is expected, which makes it less scary when it emerges unexpectedly. They give you a framework for tracking the spiral yourself. You can look back and see how your child's relationship with the loss has evolved, and they communicate to your child that you're in this for the long term. Grief isn't something you're rushing them through, it's something you're climbing through together. Now let's talk about what gets in the way, because even when you understand this method intellectually, your own fears and doubts will surface. One major obstacle is your own need to see your child move on and be happy. It's excruciating to watch your child grieve. When they seem to be doing better, you feel relief. When they spiral back to sadness, you feel like you failed to protect them. You might catch yourself subtly discouraging grief conversations, changing the subject, offering too quick reassurance, suggesting activities to distract them.
This isn't because you're a bad parent, it's because watching your child hurt is almost unbearable. But remember, you're not causing their pain by allowing the conversation. The pain is already there. You're helping them carry it by climbing alongside you instead of trying to make them skip floors. Another obstacle is comparing your child's grief journey to others. Your child's friend lost a parent the same year and she seems fine. Why is your child still struggling? Or your older child processed the loss one way, so why is your younger child so different? Every child spirals at their own pace and with their own pattern. The lighthouse metaphor is the same for everyone, but the specific windows where grief emerges differ. Some kids have more windows close together. Some skip apparent windows and hit grief hard at unexpected moments. You can't standardize this.
You might also fear that inviting reconversation will make things worse, that you're somehow reminding them of pain they'd otherwise forget. But children don't forget significant losses. They submerge them when they sense adults can't handle the conversation. By inviting reconversation, you're not creating pain. You're creating permission to acknowledge pain that already exists. Kids who feel free to express grief actually carry it more lightly than kids who hide it. Some parents get stuck thinking they need to have perfect answers. What if I don't know what to say when they ask the hard questions? Match your honesty to their developmental level. I don't know why this happened. Is it complete and appropriate answer? I wonder about that too. Creates companionship in the wondering. You're not their theology professor or their therapist. You're their parent, the steady presence who doesn't disappear when things get hard. Your willingness to stay present matters more than having perfect language. So why does this method work? Why does understanding grief as a spiral make such a difference? First, it aligns with how human development actually functions. Children's brains develop in stages, and each stage brings new cognitive capacities. A method that accounts for this matches reality, which means it won't keep failing you and making you think something's wrong. You'll stop pathologizing normal developmental grief responses. Second, it removes the pressure both you and your child feel to get over it. That pressure creates shame, secrecy, and isolation. When you release that pressure and replace it with expectation that grief will resurface, you create an environment where your child can actually process their loss honestly, instead of performing recovery to please you. Third, it gives you a roadmap for the long term. Grief in childhood isn't a crisis to manage, it's a developmental process to support over years. When you know you'll be spiraling back to this loss at different heights, you stop panicking at each return. You can prepare, you can recognize patterns, you can show up consistently instead of reactively. And finally, this method builds trust between you and your child that extends far beyond grief. When your child learns that they can bring you hard emotions repeatedly and you won't shut down, rush them, or break, they learn they can bring you anything. The lighthouse isn't just about grief, it's about becoming the kind of steady presence your child can navigate by throughout their entire life. So, you've learned about the grief spiral method. You understand now that your child isn't stuck, they're growing through their grief at each developmental stage. You know how to recognize which turn of the spiral they're on and what they need from you. Now it's time to put this into practice, right now, in this moment. While you're still listening to this, I want you to do something simple. Take a slow breath and picture your child's face, not the worried version you've been carrying around, just them, as they are, and say this to yourself: "My child isn't broken. They're meeting their grief with exactly what they have right now." That's it. You've just shifted from fixer to spiral guide. You've claimed your new identity. In the next few hours, today, you're going to have your first real conversation as a spiral guide. Find a quiet moment with your child. It doesn't need to be formal or scheduled. Maybe it's during a car ride or while making dinner together. And you're going to say something like this: "I've been thinking about how you've been feeling about Dad being gone," or whoever your loss is. Use their name, be specific. Then add,
I wonder if it feels different to you now than it did before. Like maybe you're noticing new things or asking different questions. Then stop. Just listen. Don't fix. Don't redirect. Don't worry if they don't say much. You're simply opening the door and showing them it's safe to walk through it whenever they're ready. Tomorrow, you're going to start building your observation habit. Get a notebook or open a notes app on your phone, something private, just for you. Each day, write down one thing you noticed about where your child is developmentally and one thing you noticed about their grief. It might be, Jake asked why grandma had to die, causal thinking emerging, age 7. Or Emma seems angry that her friends don't understand, teen identity focus, comparing her experience to peers. You're not analyzing or judging, you're simply becoming fluent in reading the spiral. Over the next week, you're going to practice developmental matching. Each time your child brings up their grief or you notice grief showing up in their behavior, pause and ask yourself, what developmental task are they working on right now? If they're young and asking concrete questions, answer concretely. If they're older and pushing boundaries, recognize the grief underneath the behavior.
If they're teens creating distance, respect it while staying available. You'll get this wrong sometimes. That's fine. You're learning a new language, and your child will forgive the mistakes when they feel you trying. Also this week, create one grief-safe ritual. It doesn't have to be elaborate. Maybe it's looking at photos every Sunday morning. Maybe it's lighting a candle at dinner and sharing one memory. Maybe it's a monthly visit to a special place. The content matters less than the consistency. You're building a structure that says, grief lives here. It's safe. We return to it together. By day 30, something remarkable will have happened. Your child will still have grief. That's not what changes. But they'll have something new. The felt experience that their grief doesn't scare you, that you can handle it, that you see them growing through it, rather than being diminished by it. You'll notice them bringing things to you they used to hide. You'll catch yourself responding with curiosity instead of fear. You'll see them moving between grief and joy more fluidly, because they don't have to choose between feeling their loss and having your approval. The parent you were 30 days ago was terrified their child would get stuck in grief. The spiral guide you're becoming knows that's not how this works. You understand now that your child will return to their grief again and again, and that each return is a sign of growth, not regression. Keep this episode saved. Listen again in 3 months, then 6 months, then a year. You'll hear different things each time because you'll be on your own spiral of growth, and that's exactly how this is supposed to work.